Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not so much Mr. Smith goes to Washington as it is Mr. Obama goes to Silicon Valley. The president's got a high-tech dinner date tonight. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 17th of February today. And you do sort of have to wonder how meetings like the one the president's going to have tonight work. Does he say to one of his secretaries, do you think, hey, call Steve Jobs and maybe Eric Schmidt and don't forget that Zuckerberg kid and see what they're doing for dinner on Thursday? Or does the high-tech lobby get its collective head together and make the invitation itself? However it happens, the president's off to San Francisco. It's a listening tour, if you will. The president wants to hear ideas about how to rebuild the American economy for the information age. You know, that whole innovation and win the future thing. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Here's who's coming. Apple's Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook, Google's Eric Schmidt, and Larry Ellison from Oracle, among others. More than half a dozen billionaires will be there. And while it's fun to speculate about who sits next to whom or what might come out of Larry Ellison's legendary mouth, the White House would prefer it if our coverage focused on the economy. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney says the president is
very clear in his call for the need to invest in new industries, to innovate, and to focus on the education of our children precisely in order to grow the economy and create jobs.
Judith Estrin is author of the book Closing the Innovation Gap and has bent the president's ear on innovation policy.
The products that we see around us are built on research that was done 10 and 20 years ago.
She says U.S. companies are no longer making similar investments.
The challenge for a corporation is that basic research benefits society, benefits industries, but usually does not have a direct benefit back to a specific corporation.
She says the government has a role to play, but there's no guarantee new technologies will create new jobs here. In Santa Clara County, where Google, Apple, and Facebook are headquartered, the unemployment rate is still above 10%. And while Apple employs just 30,000 people, the subcontractor, which actually assembles its products, employs more than a million. But they work in China. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
This introduction is going to be one of those that sounds a whole lot less interesting than the story actually is. But bear with me, would you? Because the Senate Banking Committee held a hearing today on the progress that regulators are making in fixing the financial system. Suffice it to say, they are making some progress on credit card fees and oversight rules, mostly. But in particular today, mishandled home foreclosures were at issue, robo-signing and wrongful evictions. The country's biggest banks have been under investigation and could be facing billions of dollars in fines. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Just a few months ago, several big banks had to freeze thousands of foreclosure cases as evidence emerged that officials were cutting corners with the paperwork. Today, a federal regulator that's been probing 14 big banks, including Wells Fargo and Bank of America, said it's found evidence of wrongdoing, though the vast majority of foreclosures were legally sound. Along with federal authorities, state attorneys general have also been investigating mortgage lending practices.
We're likely to see both a federal settlement and a state attorneys general's settlement soon.
Adam Levitin is an expert in housing law at Georgetown.
Those settlements are likely to include a monetary fine component, as well as a set of standards that servicers agree they will comply with going forward.
Levitin estimates the fines will total tens of billions of dollars. He says instead of paying the governments, banks may be required to apply that money toward helping distressed homeowners by modifying their loans. Banks have defended their foreclosure decisions as valid and the problems there were as clerical errors. Harvard housing expert Nicholas Ritsinas says the sooner state and federal regulators can hash this out, the better.
There's no question that they ought to be held accountable. On the other hand, we ought to be careful it doesn't obscure the major issue that we have a foreclosure crisis. And to the extent we delay the foreclosure process, it's going to delay the recovery.
The number of homes in foreclosure remains at historic highs, but the Mortgage Bankers Association did have some good news today. The percentage of people falling behind on their mortgage payments has slowed to pre-recession levels. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
So there are two ways to look at that win by the computer in Jeopardy last night. One is that it was an awfully expensive way and a whole lot of trouble to go to win a lousy game show. 4 years and millions of dollars. The other way to think of it is that we were seeing a slice of the future, a technological breakthrough of vital importance. Either way, companies think Watson has at least some of the answers. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Watson could easily be mistaken for a human Jeopardy contestant.
Breaking news for 800.
But a human celebrity? He's got no feel for that. IBM's lead researcher on Watson, David Ferrucci, agreed to stand in during Watson's 15 minutes of fame. I asked him which response hurt most.
Of course, you know, seeing the answer for the Toronto-Chicago one was painful.
Watson answered, "What is Toronto?" to a query in the U.S. cities category. Even Jeopardy host Alex Trebek had fun with that one.
I learned Toronto is now a U.S. city.
Ferrucci says Watson's Jeopardy win is a technological breakthrough. Artificial intelligence expert Ray Kurzweil agrees.
You know, it made some dumb mistakes that humans wouldn't make, but it made up for that and was able to win the contest because of its tremendous scale.
Watson's win has netted IBM a contract with speech recognition firm Nuance Communications and Columbia University's medical school. There may be infinite applications for Watson. Deborah Kay is CEO of innovation company Luqule.
What makes business stand still is the inability to make a decision. And what is so amazing about Watson is that it may not have the right answer, but it gives you the probabilities for the top three answers.
Kay says companies in just about every field can take it from there. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The news from the Middle East this morning, the crackdown in Bahrain specifically hit the markets today. Not equities, mind you. Stocks were boosted by some reassuring news on inflation. Oil and gold did react, though. And before we go on, here's why I love business news on television. I was walking into the studio this afternoon. I saw a headline. It said, the stocks are within 27 points of the highest level they've been in 10 years. What it didn't say was that the stocks are where they were 10 years ago. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Harvard University economist Ed Glaser likes cities. He likes them so much, in fact, that he's been known to wax poetic in describing them. Cities can be thought of, Glaser says, as the absence of physical space between people and firms. And when that absence of space gets intense enough, amazing economic things happen. Ed Glaser's new book on the world's urban centers is called Triumph of the City. Ed, welcome to the program.
Wonderful to be here.
Tell us where we've tracked you down today, would you?
I'm in the Oyster Bar in Grand Central Terminal, one of the busiest spots in town, and I'm surrounded by the historic Guastavino tiles.
Now, did you have lunch at the Oyster Bar today, or are you just hanging out?
I did not. I had a pastrami sandwich for lunch, which is awfully hard to get away from New York City, so I always try to take advantage of it when I'm here.
But the topic today is not food, actually. It's cities and the fact that it's really no accident that restaurant that you're in, the Oyster Bar, is on the concourse of one of the biggest train terminals in the country, isn't it?
Everything that grew in the 19th century in New York grew up around the port and then the rail yards. Its three largest industries were sugar refining, garment production, and printing and publishing, all three of which came out of connections with the transportation linkages in the city.
The thesis in this book is that, and I think you use these words, cities are our greatest invention.
So much of what humankind has achieved over the past three millennia has come out of the remarkable collaborative creations that come out of cities. We are a social species. We come out of the womb with the ability to sop up information from people around us. It's almost our defining characteristic as creatures. And cities play to that strength. Cities enable us to learn from other people. They enable us to become better, in a sense, by leveraging the talents of the crowds around us. When you think about all great inventions that human beings have made, from Athenian philosophy to Henry Ford's Model T's to Facebook, they were always collaborative. There was always situations in which one person borrowed an idea from someone else, and then another idea was borrowed, and then all of a sudden something absolutely magical occurred. Cities make all of that possible, and that's why I think they're not only mankind's greatest invention, but also our best hope for the future.
All right, but I want you to do something for me. Look around Grand Central. Look out onto the concourse, that huge square there. with the information booth in the middle that so many people who are listening to this have been in so many times. And look and see if you can find people who are having meaningful conversations. They're all just going, because life in a city is rough and tumble and hard, and you got to keep on going or you'll die.
You know, I'm looking, what I see right in front of me is a group of six people conversing with each other and connecting with each other. And it's hard to believe that, you know, connecting in cyberspace will ever manage to replace sharing a meal or a kiss or a smile. Certainly living in a city can be rough. Cities are places of competition. They're places of innovation. You have to continue coming up with a new thing. That's what makes them so productive.
So you make the case that cities are good for industry. You also, though, make kind of the counterintuitive case that they're good for the environment as well.
Absolutely. So let me start with a story. So in 1844, a young Harvard graduate and his friend went fishing. And when they just tried to cook the fish in a chowder, the wind flicked the flames. The flames spread, and by the time the great fiery inferno was over, they had burned down over 300 acres of prime Concord woodland. The young Harvard graduate who did this was, of course, Henry David Thoreau. Now, there's a moral to that story. We humans are a destructive species. We tend to destroy stuff when we're around it. And if you love nature, stay away from it.
Yeah.
Now, the statistical part of the book that addresses this reflects work that I've done together with UCLA economist Matthew Kahn. We've tried to measure carbon emissions associated with living in different parts of the country, and certainly we find that there's substantially lower carbon emissions associated with living in big cities than outside of them, and there are two major reasons for this, one of which is that people in cities just drive a lot less, and secondly, they live in smaller homes, which require less home heating and less home cooling. And the place where this matters, of course, is in the great growing cities of Asia. If China adapts urbanization patterns that look like New York, that are tall buildings connected with public transportation and, better yet, pedestrian walkways, China's going to end up being a whole lot greener. So I think that's one of the main reasons that we need to have this conversation, is to try and push the places where urban form is incredibly fluid and the number of bodies involved is incredibly huge, and try to at least get their urban planners to think about how different forms of cities are going to affect the environment in the long term.
Ed Glaser, he's an economist at Harvard. He's got a new book out about the cities in which we live. It's called Triumph of the City. Ed, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, as Fashion Week wraps up in New York City, how the shopping list for the well-dressed woman is about to change.
From a more feminine, pretty, looser silhouette that gradually becomes something more structured and more menswear inspired.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 29 points today, about 0.25%, settled at 12,318. The NASDAQ rose 6 points, 0.2%, 28.31 at the bell. The S&P 500 met the tape at 4 points higher, 0.3%, 1340 at the close. Shares of the tech company NVIDIA jumped nearly 10% today. The maker of computer graphic processing chips released an upbeat revenue forecast. An increase in crude oil futures was good news for the energy sector. Shares of ConocoPhillips pumped up 1.75%. Chevron filled up 0.5%. ExxonMobil spurted higher 0.2% today. Dr. Pepper Snapple Group, which if you ask me is just too much of a mouthful. Anyway, it bubbled up more than 5.5% after the company's profit beat Wall Street expectations. Rival Coca-Cola fizzled up 1.8% higher today. U.S. Airways cruised lower more than 1.75% after rolling back a fare increase. Delta descended 1.4% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.58%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. President Obama is in Oregon visiting Intel Corporation. A two-day meeting of the group of 20 finance ministers convenes in Paris. And he's remembered for 16 Candles and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, among other films. Writer and director John Hughes was born on February 18, 1950. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. While he was standing at the Oyster Bar at Grand Central Station, Ed Glaser offered a quick tutorial about how important centralized transportation was to the rise of American cities, railroads, and rivers mostly back then. An analogy for today might be modern transit lines, moving people, not things. Because even though a nice house out in the suburbs, white picket fence and all, is the prototypical American dream, truth is, a lot of home buyers are voting with their feet and choosing to live within walking distance of public transit. From Public Radio's Transportation Nation Project at WNYC, Andrea Bernstein reports.
In 1977, when 11-year-old Terry Alexander moved with his parents and younger sister to Park Slope, Brooklyn, the city's population was rapidly contracting. Whites, in particular, were fleeing the city for the suburbs. But Alexander, who's African-American, moved with his family from the Manhattan Projects to a brownstone in Park Slope, Brooklyn. In those days, no one could understand why. In a word, it was
horrible. There were many stabbings and fights.
Alexander still lives in the house he grew up in. Today, it's one of the toniest neighborhoods in New York City, just a 20-minute subway ride from Manhattan.
Mom, I love you. You were dead wrong this once.
In 1977, the Alexander home cost $68,000. Today, it's worth more than $2 million. Turns out this pattern is a national phenomenon. Chris Leinberger, a University of Michigan professor and visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, says you can see it in San Francisco, Boston, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. He gestures to a gorgeous townhouse in DuPont Circle with a detailed balcony and an impeccably trimmed Japanese maple out front. But Leinberger says it's not the nice touches pushing up this home's value. It's the proximity to Washington's transit system, the Metro.
Within walking distance of transit, we're seeing anywhere from a 40 to 200% price premium. The market is willing to pay 40% more to three times more.
After the housing bubble burst in 2007, Leinberger says homes and neighborhoods around the country like Park Slope and DuPont Circle largely held their value. Census figures show that in the last 10 years, these neighborhoods have become increasingly white. We drive 45 minutes outside D.C., beyond the border of the metro, to Prince George's County. In this area, the population is two-thirds black.
We're now looking for Fairview Vista.
We drive through a suburban subdivision with large new homes. They've got two-car garages, brick details, and window shutters. We stop in front of one on a quarter-acre lot. Its value? $365,000. One-fifth as much as the DuPont Circle row house.
This is a car-dependent house. You cannot live here without taking your car to literally every trip from your home.
As Americans increasingly choose to live near transit, the value of homes like this has plummeted 60% since the year 2000.
The bulk of the mortgage meltdown took place here. It didn't take place in DuPont.
To be sure, not everyone wants to live in cities. The suburban ideal still has a hold on some. After immigrating from Haiti, Patrice Prévillon moved to an urban area in New York City. Then he moved with his four children to a Long Island suburb with no transit.
I love peace and quiet. That's why I moved to Elmont. Elmont is a good residential area. It's a very good place to raise kids, so that's why I live in Elmont.
But still, Leinberger says, even in the more established suburbs, homes have lost value in the last several years. And with gas prices rising and families getting smaller, he says it's a trend that's likely to continue. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
There was a time when massive transportation projects swept the nation. We built the New York City subway, the Erie Canal, the interstate highway system.
Commentator Angela Glover-Blackwell.
But over time, that bold spirit seemed to leak away. Soon, politics took over the way we spend money on transportation. We entered an age that pleased car-loving middle-class suburban voters and created a nationwide system of haves and have-nots. Elevated highways left gashes through poor black urban neighborhoods. Superhighways kept sprawling into the exurbs. We forgot that smart, effective, affordable transportation options are what make America run. We need to be fairer and smarter about the way we think about transportation. Instead, many in Congress are labeling crucial transportation projects as pork and are eagerly threatening deep cuts that can hurt transit systems that are just barely getting by. And that's on top of the drastic cuts already happening at the city and state level. More than 90% of all transit systems had to cut service or raise fares last year. That's a double whammy for poor people who rely on public transit. Millions of working people have to walk farther to the bus stop and pay more when they get on. And the people being laid off by the public transit systems, the bus drivers, the ticket booth operators, the mechanics, are disproportionately people of color. Black unemployment is nearly double the rate of whites. But the good news is that transportation investments pay off now and in the future. They create jobs. They get people to their jobs. And investments in public transit pay off even more, creating more construction and operating jobs per dollar spent than comparable highway projects. Transportation is the engine that powers our economy. Let's make sure it connects and serves all Americans.
Angela Glover-Blackwell is the president of the research group PolicyLink. Andrea Bernstein's story on the value of transit was adapted from the American Radio Works and Transportation Nation documentary Back of the Bus. We've got a link where you can hear the whole thing and leave us your comments as well. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Every year around this time, I learn just a little bit more about women's clothes. Let me explain. Fashion Week wraps up in New York City today. Designers and runway models all over the place. New looks as well, one of which was suits on the women. Pinstripes, double-breasted blazers, you get the idea. When we want to talk fashion, we call Kate Betts. She helps keep me out of trouble. Kate, it's good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me.
Help me out with this menswear on women thing. First of all, and we'll get to this in a minute, I've seen it before, but tell us what this looks like. Is it really just suits?
I think it's a mix. I think we're seeing some pantsuits and kind of a more minimalist feeling in the tailoring. It's not a literal translation, obviously, of menswear, but we are seeing a more structured kind of return to suiting.
The last time you and I talked actual fashion, it was colors, flowers, long skirts, dresses were big. I mean, make up your minds, people, right?
Oh, well, wait a minute. This is fashion, Kai. I mean, fashion always reacts to itself. It's sort of the flip-flop thing. You know, one season it's an extreme, maybe floral print feminine thing, and then it always reacts against itself and goes in the exact opposite direction. Otherwise, we wouldn't feel like we needed to buy anything new every season, right?
But we have seen this before, right? I mean, I'm going to date myself here, but you go back to Annie Hall. I mean, it's like every 10 or 15 years you get women wearing suits.
Yeah, I think there is always a general cycle from a more feminine, pretty, looser silhouette that gradually becomes something more structured and more menswear inspired. And I think, yes, we are going back in that direction. A lot of it has to do with the fact that minimalism is back and designers are kind of cleansing the palette and showing plainer clothes, you know, less prints, more solid colors. And so that has something to do with it. But also people buy tailored clothing. That's what people invest in. They're usually the more expensive pieces, yeah. And they're usually the kind of pieces that need to fit better and look better in more expensive fabrics. So, you know, the higher end designers are sort of cashing in on that, I think.
Well, so let me ask you a question on behalf of the beleaguered female American consumer. She sees this stuff on the runways, wants to be trendy and stylish, and yet it seems like every time she turns around, there's something else that she needs to pick up on based on what the fashion designers are saying. What's she supposed to do?
Well, let me correct you because I don't think she's beleaguered at all.
Right.
First of all, there's never been a time when there's been more choice in terms of price points in fashion. When you look at the runways of Michael Kors and Oscar de la Renta, obviously those are the really high, high end. And some of those places are where the trends start, but everything trickles down to H&M, to, you know, Zara, to The Gap. You can buy almost any trend almost 3 to 6 weeks after you see it on the runway in these mass market retailers now.
But I guess that's my point, right? Because the speed at which fashion is moving means that shoppers, male and females, need to buy more to keep up. Or do I have that wrong?
They have to buy smarter, I guess. Yes, they do. And if they want to keep up, I mean, I think also in an economy like this where everything is so uncertain, maybe the designers are offering something that's a little more classical and lasting. So it's more of an investment.
Kate Betts, her new book about Michelle Obama and the power of her style is called Everyday Icon. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
If you want to check out the menswear for women trend yourself, our slideshow of styles comes straight from New York Fashion Week. It's on our website, marketplace.org. This final note today in which the foreclosure shoe is firmly on the other foot. You know how we were explaining earlier how some of the big banks have been caught mishandling foreclosure paperwork and foreclosing on people who shouldn't have been? Well, bad paperwork does cut the other way, too. You know, one Patrick Rogers of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, got into a beef with his mortgage lender, Wells Fargo, as it happens, over insurance requirements. The bank didn't answer his letter within the time period specified by the law, so Rogers took him to court. He won, and the bank still blew him off. So he has now filed for a sheriff's lien and foreclosure of the Wells Fargo home mortgage office in Philadelphia, to which one can only say, so there, right? That's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow climbed 29 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 6 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 edged up 4 points, 0.3% on that particular index. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up back here next time, rules for leading your life offline, at least mostly offline.
Don't read your email in the morning. And when you do read your email, don't read every single one of them.
How do you not read every one of them? Come on. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.